This is Bernie Chappell, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 18th of September 2012. Bernie Chappell, Part 2.
We hinted earlier that you formed some friendships with the Argentinians and that you were the first person to kind of go across there and say hello. Is that true?
Yes. As far as I can remember, yes.
Tell me about that relationship.
Well, it began with I developed a severe toothache, and I was not prepared. There were people on base, obviously Dave Walsh is the base leader, and the diesel mechanic, Jeff Hodson, who volunteered their services, you know, to extract said bad tooth. But I'd heard that the Argentinians did have a doctor on base. So I thought that was going to be my best option. So on a day off, as soon as I was able, I walked around the island to the Argentinian base. On the way, visiting the Chileans, who we had met up with previously, and the male nurse on the Chilean base, a chap called Benavides, said he would come round and offer his assistance. So he and others followed me around, but I was in such agony that I carried on my own.
How are you communicating with these Spanish-speaking people?
Well, initially, with great difficulty, because there was only Pablo, I think, on base, and one or two other Argentinians who spoke halting English. But Pablo spoke near perfect English, but I didn't meet him straight away. So they couldn't quite work out why it was I'd turned up, you know, as I did. But I had, by then, a few words of Spanish, so managed to make clear. And then Pablo appeared, and things were set in motion to extract said tooth.
Successfully?
Yes. But initially, the Novocaine didn't work. And apparently, it had been on base for a year or two and lost its potency. So after 15 injections and nothing seemed to happen, the doctor, forgot his name, the doctor on base decided to use ether.
Dr. Soria.
Soria.
Mario Hernando Soria.
Soria, yes, that's it.
So he removed your tooth for you?
He did.
And did that begin the kind of friendship, cross-party friendship, with the Argentinians?
It did, because they were a very friendly bunch. Apart, the base leader was a little aloof. And I don't think was quite sure about this, you know, creating a liaison between certainly the Brits and themselves.
Even in the 60s, there was a certain amount of difference of opinion about the Falklands, wasn't there, with the Argentinians?
Oh, yes, very much so. Yeah.
So was that getting in the way?
Yes, and I suppose he was doing his official bit by intimating that we were on their territory, sort of thing. Falklands, I don't think, were ever mentioned. No. Obvious reasons. But I was made to feel that we were the interlopers and not themselves.
Deception was an Argentinian island and you shouldn't be there. But that was from the top.
Yes.
Whereas the ratings, because it was a military base. Yeah. No problem at all.
Didn't mean a thing to them particularly, no. We were just a group of chaps, you know, in an isolated spot on three places on the island, and we ought to mix a good deal more than we had, i.e. there was no mixing.
Well, was there a reluctance amongst your British colleagues to socialise with the...
Obviously, I was not aware of the political situation, or it was never... I was never made aware that I often acted, knowing full well that I may be stepping over the mark, but I often acted on my own volition rather than consulting, perhaps when I should have done officially, because I saw the whole thing as quite as utter nonsense.
Mm.
The fact, even the fact that we shouldn't be associating particularly with the Chileans, you know, who we were and always have been sort of friendly with, I thought was odd. So I didn't. I think I made a mental. What's the word?
Note? Effort?
Yes, to meet the Argentinians in particular, because they had such a reputation, and the Chileans, because they were so friendly. They'd visited us, but we...
The Chileans had been to...
To our base.
Base B, yeah. Yeah.
But we hadn't been to them. And because of the politics on our base, other people who might have been interested in meeting up with the Chileans again and the Argentinians. So it needed somebody to break the ice, in a way. And the most naive person on base was myself, and I took it upon myself to... break the ice, if you like, but fortuitously with a bad case of toothache.
So did you consult the base leader, Dave Walters, about?
No.
He just went?
I just knew what the answer would be.
Right. How was his reaction when you got back one tooth fewer than when you left?
I wasn't admonished at all. For what I'd done, and I think the fact that I'd sort of broken the ice, this is how I remember it anyway.
That's all you can do.
Yeah. was a relief to the other guys on base who would have liked to have, you know, met up with the Argentinians in particular.
Mm.
But we're reluctant to do so because it might upset the base leader, i.e. Dave.
So how did this settle down then? How did it lead to weekly soirees and so on?
There wasn't that much to-ing and fro-ing. I think I had more opportunity, particularly when there was sea ice in the bay. I could cross, you know, to the Chileans and on my regular... dog exercise runs. So I got to know them, you know, a lot better than other people on base.
They were there militarily.
Yes.
Some of them have been sent there rather than chosen to go, I suspect.
Yes.
Whereas you were all there because you wanted to be.
Yeah.
Did you spot any kind of difference of attitude or opinion or culture between the two bases?
Not really. I mean, there was the military aspect, but on the Chilean base it was very relaxed. And on the Argentinian base to a large extent, because a number of them were civilians anyway, they weren't going to knuckle down, you know, to their base leader, if you like.
Mm.
And largely, I think the Argentinians very quickly relaxed, even the base leader there. And part of that may have been due to, I mean, he was interested in meeting me and talking about, you know, as much as we could talk about. Peter Bird followed me to the Ard. I think he was quite interested in meeting up with the Argentinians and was quite impressed with their... because he was a sort of educated guy, their base leader. And there was quite a rapport between Peter and he.
Did Peter speak Spanish then?
He did have some Spanish.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was there any trading? Because Pablo Justo surprised me by suggesting that the Argentinians didn't have any beef worth eating and all their wine was off. So was there any exchanges of produce?
There were exchanges, and I thought about that the other day, and I was trying to remember. I don't think there was an awful lot. I think cigarettes might have been one thing. They and us, in a way, were as much interested in sampling their culinary delights as they were in sampling ours. Mm. You know. So I can't remember an awful lot of trading. No.
Did things change when a ship came in? Because I know that the Argentinian had a fairly important visit, and I guess the British ships were coming and going occasionally.
Yes, we sort of lost touch, if you like. Not with the Chileans, but certainly with the Argentinians. Once the military arrived, yes.
So you were pretending you weren't fraternising?
Not us particularly. We didn't do a lot of socialising with the... people that visited from off base.
Sorry, what I meant was that when a ship came in, you and the Argentinian bases didn't communicate quite so much until the ship went away again. So it was a bit of hide and seek going on.
Oh, yes.
Whilst the cat's away, the mice will play.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see the attraction of having an enlarged social circle on such a remote island as Deception.
Hmm. Yes, but I think the people on the British base are so interesting anyway. And knew when to not hide themselves away, but do their own thing in their own quiet way. And, you know, there was a lot of respect, inter-respect. You know, between the individuals on Deception. So, and an understanding that we all came from wholly different backgrounds.
Mm.
So, you know, I don't remember. what was the original question? I forgot.
I think we kind of dealt with it.
Dealt with it, right.
Anyway, they'll move on.
Yeah.
As the year came to a close, you were looking to go further south, as you said earlier, that you were keen to sample the deeper Antarctic. So how did that come about? Did you ask to go to Adelaide Island, or were you sent?
You were given the option. And if it fell in with plans at Cambridge, then that was okay. So if people needed to be replaced on Stonington or Adelaide or wherever, Argentine, then we would be the people, the natural progression, if you like. And I expressed the wish at an early stage to go on a what you call a proper sledging base, to have that experience. And as it turned out, Peter Bird had the same desire. He wanted to experience things further south, whereas the other people on base were either going home or quite happy where they were.
So you and Peter both transferred to Adelaide,
yeah,
in 66.
Yes.
And you picked up the dog team there as well?
Yes.
Were they different?
Straight away.
Sorry?
Straight away.
Tell me about the dog team you inherited on Adelaide.
Well, they were a much younger group of dogs, and the breeding program had moved with me. So I was supplied with suitable females with which to breed, and quite a sizable team of dogs. I used to run, for exercise purposes, I used to run an 11 dog team, which was quite unusual. Largest dog teams are normally eight or nine. But to sort of get through the day, I had to control 11 dogs instead of 9. But by then, I think I was quite accomplished anyway. So,
and this team of dogs were doing serious surveying work, I presume?
Had been doing, but they were, again, they weren't being used, because we had no, on Adelaide Island, we had no surveyors or the people doing the field work on base who would require a dog team at the time. So they were purely left with me for recreational purposes and part of the breeding program.
You were involved in something called Decca Hyphix. I'm afraid I don't know what that is.
It's a seabed sounding. So you get the...
Fathoms deep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Topography of the seabed around all the islands. A very precise method, apparently, at the time.
Was this being used on a dinghy? Or?
No, it was being used... I don't know whether they used a triangulation, and probably did, but it was one of the survey ships. In our case, it was the John Biscoe, and then shore base, which is what I was on, looking after the shore base.
That was another skill that had to be learned, I guess.
Well, yes, looking after the Decca Hyphix staff. I did that on Anvers Island as well as out in the Margaret Bay on the Boris Fawes Island. So I'd already had some experience before looking after the base camp, if you like, on, I've just mentioned it, Maurice Falls Island.
Mm. Yeah. So we're going to Fossil Bluff, because you did go off there with Peter Bird.
Yes.
For one expedition, which is even further south.
A lot further south, yes. The furthest south, apart from Halley Bay, British base. Yes, if the other bases were remote, this was very remote. Small base, absolutely idyllic setting. We were there to check over the engines and the stores, because there was a possibility that later in the year people doing survey work and geology work on the mainland would come over to the base and spend the winter there.
So was Fossil Bluff actually not staffed at that point?
No.
Okay. What do you make of it?
Absolutely. If you can conjure up a picture of the Antarctic, deep south, I don't know from our joint experience whether you would have observed anything quite like Fossil Bluff. I mean, you are talking Antarctic proper. Just an idyllic spot.
Was it called Bluebell Cottage by that time?
No. I heard that one. No.
I think so. I think women who've been down there since have rather Laura Ashford. Yes.
Right.
Okay. You did some flying as well, which again was another departure for Mr. Chappell.
Yes. I took the opportunity whenever possible to fly with the aircraft wherever they were going. And quite a number of people on base were reluctant, knowing that there was possibilities that things might not go quite as they should. But I was, I suppose, a little bit more gung-ho, so I volunteered whenever possible to effectively go as co-pilot, because there'd be only the pilot and myself on board.
Well, you flew with Jules Brett, didn't you, around Deception Island?
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
That was... they had to do test flights, obviously, before going south. So... I took the opportunity, whenever Jules was going up, to go with him. He always had to have somebody with him. And the air mechanics were always reluctant to go. So,
what did they know that you didn't?
Well, exactly, yes. I think they just had that, much experience, and obviously if anything did go wrong, they weren't too happy about being crashing in some remote spot. And and having to get back to civilization, if you like.
We're talking about single otters, I think, aren't we here?
Yeah.
And you flew with Bob Burgess as well when he got to Adelaide Island.
Yes. On a number of occasions, yes.
There's one in particular which you've noted here. You were heading south from Adelaide.
We were heading... something I'd wanted to do was go on to the mainland proper, i.e. the ice Piedmont of Antarctic, and I had the opportunity. So, I volunteered whenever it was possible to go up with Bob. And on one occasion, he wasn't too happy about going this particular day. And it was very quickly after takeoff that he realised that things weren't all they should have been. The radio cable snapped. I think that was the first thing. Then he couldn't retrieve one of the skis, so we had a ski down, a ski up. So he was trying to work out how he was going to land in such a circumstance. I don't think we actually went anywhere that time. I think he turned around, the weather was getting that bad that he turned around and we landed back at Adelaide.
How did he land?
He managed to, I think there's a cranking method, a mechanical method of pumping the ski down, which he had to do for us to land, yeah. And that worked.
So there was that suggests a sense of health and safety, almost, of caution amongst pilots. So was that a general approach you felt from pilots, that they were very careful, or were there gung-ho elements as well?
I obviously hadn't ever experienced being with pilots previously, and when the first time I went up with Jules Brett, I was thinking, well, he's sort of gung-ho, and all the stories he's come out with of his experiences in the RAF. But once in the cockpit, it was a changed man.
Oh, right.
And they're both Bob Burgess and Jules are the same. Although Bob Burgess was the same on land or in the air. Jules was a totally different character once it was takeoff time. And I would initially, I do remember carrying on in the same jokey vein with him, because he was such a hell of a nice guy, Jules. You've met, yeah. But he didn't want to know, you know, he was in charge of his aircraft and that was that, and I had to quickly learn, you know, to keep my mouth shut and do as I was told, yeah.
Tell me about some of the scary moments. You've got a list here which goes from A to J, so there must have been quite a few. Perhaps I could guide you through them. Forming a bridge across a crevasse with an Anton sledge.
That was on Adelaide Island. I was following the Muskeg tractor. We'd been out on a Piedmont heighting survey for a week or two with George Green and Peter Bird. Yeah. They were in the tractor. And when it came to going home, going back to base, George was obviously in a hurry as the driver, and he shot off ahead, and it was just a speck in the distance with me following along behind on my own, which I was quite happy with. But unfortunately, he'd taken a direct route home, which led me straight into a crevassed area. And I stopped by quite a large hole, not knowing whether to go back or forward or what to do. And I thought, well, the lay of the land looks slightly better going forward than going backwards, because the tractor had opened up quite a number of crevasses. So I bridged crevasse, and that was quite an exercise, getting the dogs over the bridge using the sledge, harnessing them up again, and then sort of veering off seaward to get away out of this crevassed area. Obviously the dogs wanted to follow the tracks of the tractor. Easy for them. So they were reluctant, but eventually I managed to get them away. And I made my own way back.
There were a couple of incidents at Lincoln's Nunatak, again with dogs involved.
Yes.
This is again on Adelaide Island, is it?
On Adelaide Island, yeah. Yes. Lincoln Nunatak was a hillock, if you like, or a small rocky hill, but formed from it was a huge ice scoop. And I had to avoid this, obviously, because at its highest it was something like, can't remember exactly, but it was something like 200 feet high. So quite something to go over if to open. But for some reason, the dogs wished to go over. And I was trying to get a view of where the Muskeg tractor was so I could decide on a route to get to them. And halfway down this wind scoop, the dogs decided they'd had enough, they wanted to go direct, the direct route rather than, which was often the case. And as much as I pleaded, they went over the edge and down we went. But it was no more than, I'd say, 70, 80 foot by then. So although we all ended up in a heap at the bottom, no bones broken, including this half. But quite...
Was your life flashing before your eyes? Or
you no, saying? I was just attempting to keep some sort of control.
Mm.
Because halfway down the scoop, the dogs were still in line, running like the blazes, but not actually tumbling. Mm. It's only after we got over the halfway point that they started doing tumbles themselves. And fortunately, I had my foot well and truly on the brake, but the sledge was going down in that fashion, how you described that.
Well, the rear of the sledge was
digging into the ice and snow.
Right.
But the front of the sledge was in midair.
Right.
Yeah.
The Wellington boot effect.
Yeah.
You had a rather nervous night at Lincoln Nunatak in a storm. Was that around the same time, or was that later?
That was the same time.
It was the same time.
When I managed to contract snow blindness, was that? Or, oh, no.
You had lost Peter Bird
and George Green. Yes, and George Green had been out surveying, hadn't returned, and then a storm blew, quite a severe storm. Can't remember how long it lasted, but I was beginning to fear for their safety. And in fact, they if it was 24 hours, they spent a horrendous 24 hours with very little food and in a bad place, if you like. While I was in the tented area. On my own.
They didn't have a tent?
No.
Right.
No, I sat in the cab. Yeah.
What had happened to Peter and George, and how were you reunited?
Well, as soon as the weather turned, I got together my dog team and went out to look for them. And they weren't in a particularly bad state when I actually found them. They'd spent the night in the cab, absolutely frozen.
In the cab?
In the cab of the Muskeg tractor. Sorry. With not a lot to sort of keep them warm, particularly. So I think it was pretty horrendous. Now, I've never heard a great deal from Peter about it, other than that it was particularly cold and, quite an experience.
You had a couple of very interesting moments with a pram dinghy, I believe, as well.
Yes, Adelaide Island, I often used to trip across on my own to... Avian Island, which wasn't too far from the base. And this was to watch the bird life in particular. And on one occasion, I was the pram dinghy isn't a big craft by any means. 8 foot long, I would think, by memory. Very small. And when somebody like as big as myself got in it, then it was quite interesting.
It was lying low, was it?
Yeah. Not just lying low, the front... Yes.
Would rise.
So you weren't very far from the sea at the rear controlling the engine. And on leaving base on one occasion, I was followed quite closely by a leopard seal, very curious to see what was going on. And he followed me all the way over to the island, and these are quite large creatures, particularly fierce looking because they've got a good set of teeth. He was just curious, obviously, but I don't know. I suppose I had to steady my nerves somewhat. Because he was quite close, within sort of 3 or 4 feet.
Did he ever fear for your life in those 2 years?
It's a very strange thing in retrospect. Some of the things I did and some of the things I got up to, they could easily have gone wrong.
Hmm.
But it didn't appear, didn't ever have any thoughts, as to my own
mortality.
Thank you. It was merely coping with that situation and carrying on to the next one.
One situation was again in a pram dinghy, sharing a pram dinghy with Jeff Hodson in inclement weather.
This was returning from the Argentinian base. I was a little bit worried about the weather conditions because obviously in the Antarctic it can blow up within minutes.
So was this at Adelaide or was it...
This was at Deception.
Deception, yeah.
Island, yeah.
Yeah.
This was after I'd had my tooth removed.
Okay.
Jeff came over to pick me up, insisted that he was needed back on base, so we had to make the return journey. And as soon as we left the Argentinian base, it blew up. The wind got very strong. There's only one way we were going, and that was towards the glacier. There was a glacier between our base and the Chilean base, and that's where we were heading. So Jeff had to edge, he was in control of the tiller, edge the boat towards a landing point. And some of the waves were, because these pram dinghies were not... because I've already described, some of the waves were almost boiling over the back of the boat, and I didn't, to me, sat at the front. Jeff seemed to be well in control. So I didn't, but I did keep sort of talking to him and as we were going across, and we edged away from the glacier and managed to land. But he was in quite a state when we landed and sort of ran off back towards base and left me with the boat.
Really?
Yeah.
Was he frightened? He was actually frightened.
He was very frightened, yes. Yeah. Quite upset. Yeah, apologised later for leaving me in that situation, but I was only thankful that he sort of held his nerve, because we could easily have overturned. Because it was a very, very choppy sea, and we were sort of sliding back down waves. And
that's what happens in the Antarctic, isn't it? Things become cumulative. Something happens, then something else happens on top of that, and then then it slightly worsens, and suddenly you have a full-scale crisis almost from nowhere.
Yeah.
There's a rather odd one when you were working in a loft space on an Nansen sledge when things are happening which you hadn't quite realised at the time.
Yes, well, I was... it's a thing, anybody that travels with dogs needs to put together their own sledge. This is like an unwritten rule. So that if anything goes wrong out in the field, one, you know how to repair it, and if something seriously goes wrong with the mechanics of the sledge, then you've only yourself to blame. So that's the mindset. So I'd already done one at Deception. So I was quite experienced. But the working area was quite cramped in the loft of the Radio Shack, I think it was. Yeah, not the Radio Shack. The workshop. Yeah. And when I came to go back to the main hut, found I couldn't actually stand up. So I had to go through a hole in the floor and lower myself down to ground floor in agony.
Had you actually kind of frozen?
No. I'd done something. I slipped a disc.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And it locked. So I couldn't stand up. Then had to... this was at night, it was dark. Had crawl in a blow. Or a storm. Crawl back from there up what we called High Street at Adelaide Island to the main hut, living hut. And I did that, but with all the snow blowing around, and I was finding it very difficult, I had to feel for, there was like a ridge going up what we call High Street, feel for the ridge, and then realise how far I was away from the hut when I got to that point, and then make for the hut. So it was that serious a blow. Anyway, I managed to get back to the main hut, but couldn't open the door because it was too high off the ground. You know, I couldn't stretch that far. So I was knocking on the door, and it being soundproofed and I don't know how many inches thick, nobody could hear. But eventually somebody came out at the door, and I managed to get in. So, yeah, quite an interesting episode.
Was that a close call?
No.
You were never in danger of...
No.
And how did you resolve the back problem? Was there a doctor on? No, there's no doctor on
the base. No doctor. No. The base leader on Adelaide, a chap called George Green, he rang through to Port Stanley and got some idea of how to sort of treat me. But basically it was lying on a flat board for however long. It was until things went right again.
Are you okay now, 50 years later?
I've suffered with back trouble ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've often heard people talk about the eruptions on Deception, but you actually experienced an earthquake on Deception, which I've not come across before.
Mm, quite serious.
When would this be? This would be 60...
65.
Tell me about what happened,
please. Well, we'd all retired to our bunks.
So it was night time.
Night time, and night time by a good 2-3 hours, I think. And for some reason, I woke to find the hut shaking quite violently. And I thought I was experiencing it on my own, but in fact, Jeff Hodson, the diesel mechanic, he experienced it as well. He sort of shouted across the bunk room, anybody awake? And it was quite violent, quite worrying in a way.
Well, you were, of course, in the cone of a volcano, right?
Yes, yeah. Which eventually blew up, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, what happened once you'd realised what it was?
Again, I think we just accepted that might happen from time to time because we were inside an active volcano and you could see signs of it all around the island. There were hot spots in the sea, fumaroles we call them, bubbling away.
Did the earthquake do any damage?
Not that I can remember, no. No.
Were there amusing incidents too, things that made you laugh, either at the time or in retrospect?
Oh, constantly.
One involving Ken Doyle.
Oh, that was a classic, yes, yes.
Tell me the story, please.
He was an explosive expert. He worked in mines for most of his life, or around mines. And responsible in part for building a jetty, a concrete jetty at Adelaide Island. But at the beginning of the process, there's quite a lot of explosives being used to make a way down to the jetty, if you like.
Track.
And procedure then for most of us, because obviously this is quite a spectacular thing to observe, was to get well away whenever the explosives were being used. But for Ken, and I can't remember who was working with him, but for Ken certainly, he was only able to light the fuse and only able to dodge round the nearest large rock to escape the blast.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a classic view of a large rock being hurled into the air, and you couldn't have placed it any better than right on top of the Ken's head, you know, which obviously was hilarious at the time, but not a good thing for Ken. And he was quite seriously wounded by it. But we all thought it was hilarious. Yeah, there you go.
And again, there was no doctor?
No. No. I don't think... I can't remember if they actually ended up with stitches or not. But it was always a case of... If you had things like that, then you read through the manuals. You know, we had all the information down there. And if there was a real difficulty, then it was getting through to Stanley. Port Stanley.
The radio doctor was in Port Stanley?
Yes.
In those days?
Yeah.
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 When it came time for you to leave at the end of your 2.5 years, do you recall what your feelings were? Were you glad to get out or... reluctant to let to go? Or both, of course, is also possible.
Reluctant to go, thinking at the time that I'd like to revisit. I wanted... my ambition, really, was to work with dogs, full stop, as what they call a gash hand, dog driver, helping the surveyors or the scientists. So my idea was to return to the UK via South America and America, do that journey, spend maybe 6 months back in the UK before returning. So I did apply to return, but the only job they offered was on South Georgia, and I didn't altogether fancy that, so...
So, but you did return, albeit 35 years later.
Yes.
On the Marguerite Bay 2000 trip, which is where we first met.
Yes.
How was that for you? For me, it was fascinating because I'd never been there before. For you, you were comparing it to what you recalled from 35 years before.
Yes. I was very interested to see Deception Island, of course, and all the destruction there. Although not as much destruction as I had imagined. Still, quite a lot of destruction. And the fact that on Deception Island, the only bunk remaining was mine. And a lot of people kept saying to me... how much they preferred our time down there rather than the revisit, because things had changed quite considerably. But I didn't see it like that. I thoroughly enjoyed that trip as much as my 2.5 years, for different reasons. A lot more wildlife around when we went in 2000, which interests me a lot. And it was a different. I just saw it as a completely different experience, mixing with people like yourself.
People say it was a different place, partly because of the retreat of the ice in the interim decade.
Yes,
but also because the Fids are a different breed now. Well, how would you relate? How would you compare your generation of Fids to the guys and girls who were at Rothera in 2000?
It didn't really come home to me until we were sat having coffee and whatever with the people at Rothera, and discovering that they were totally in awe of characters like ourselves. I don't know, because we'd lived the life of a truly, as they saw it, a true Antarctic explorer type, whereas they were completely cosseted and there were rules and regs and they couldn't do this and they couldn't do that. I don't think they were unhappy about that, because they seem to me anyway, to want those sort of limitations, those sort of rules, whereas there were none virtually when we were there in the 60s, certainly.
Did they almost regard you as the tail end of the heroic era? Or do you regard yourself like that?
Not at all. But that's the impression I got, yes. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, they were in awe, I found astonishing.
Rothera today is thousands of steps away from Scott and Shackleton. Yeah. You were only 2 or 3 steps away from Scott and Shackleton.
Very little difference, yes. Yeah. Even the clothing, the food was very similar to Scott and Shackleton's time. Yeah, not a lot had changed.
Whereas Rothera 2000, and it's evolved even more in the 12 years since that trip that we took, it was a university that happened to be in the Antarctic.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yes. An era gone.
What do you make of the reunions? I've seen you at a couple, in fact several, I think. Marguerite Bay and...
Yes. It's very useful for me to meet up with my colleagues, diminishing year by year, but and chat about old times. But I'm as much interested in those that came after us, or even before. But I find that trying to get information from people sort of, I don't know, 80s onwards is very difficult, because they led a different life to us. And not able to talk, I mean, one of my main things was being with the dogs. Which a lot of Fids Bass people experienced in my era. So that, you know, it's like a commonality. And the conditions for us were totally different, you know, from the people that came in the 80s, as you've already said.
When you came back to Britain, you actually changed your career path completely. You sidestepped away from catering and became involved in marine biology and worked for environment agencies and river authorities. Did you ever, were you ever conscious of using stuff you learnt in the Antarctic about yourself or the environment in your new career? Were you applying concepts
you learned? Not really. Because previous to that, I hadn't really mixed with academics at all. So I wasn't aware of the sort of gulf between, you know, myself and the likes of them. But the Antarctic taught me that the gulf wasn't that wide. And as soon as I returned and decided I wasn't going down to the, I wasn't going to make the Antarctic my sort of
career.
Thank you. That I'd always had an interest in science, so, and in particular biology. So I thought, well, go for it, and. Spent 7 years gaining a degree.
At Liverpool?
Yeah.
But the point I was asking was whether you felt that in your later career, either as a scientist or in management, there were bits of the Antarctic that kept cropping up that you thought, oh, I know how to deal with this because of something I learnt when I was down there. Management.
Yeah, well, that cropped up through life, you know, away from work as well. But certainly at work, it's helped me as I've progressed up the ladder. Many of my experiences and mixing with disparate peoples has helped me enormously, you know, to cope with that rise in status, if you like. Yes.
Final question. How does the Antarctic, those Antarctic years, rate in the life of Bernie Chappell?
Pretty much first and foremost, really. I don't think there's, as you've no doubt heard from many others, it's an experience that can't be duplicated, I don't think, in any other sphere. And a one I would not have missed for the world. Yeah.
Thank you very much.